Today, he is well known as Lord Peter Thomas Bower, the author of numerous works on the economics of development. Yet, he was born Pieter Tamás Boer in Budapest, Hungary in 1915, and came to the United Kingdom to study at Cambridge in the 1930s.
My father, my late father, was a bookmaker, bookie, and one of his clients suggested, who was a great Anglophile, suggested to my father that he should try and provide an English education for his very hard-working and apparently quite talented son. So that's how I came to get it. In fact, presented myself at six colleges. Five accepted me immediately, and the sixth the next day.
Ultimately, his economic views turned him in a direction quite different from the Keynesian school of thought so prevalent at Cambridge in that era. And instead, he developed a more laissez-faire conviction. In the mid-40s, he published an initial work regarding the rubber industries in Malaya, which began the formulation of his views on economic development. Views that were expanded and built upon in over 40 years of prolific writing. Lord Bower's thinking presented a new view of the role of government intervention in the development of third world economies. His work illustrated that private entrepreneurs were more likely to be engines of development, and that Western aid was often more likely to perpetuate poor government policies and corruption rather than foster true economic vitality. Lord Bower taught at the London School of Economics from 1960 through 1983. In 1985, Lord Bower became a life peer in recognition of his distinguished service. And throughout his career, he has devoted himself in writing and in thought to furthering the understanding of how best to develop a prosperous economy while maintaining individual freedom.
I understand that as a teenager you enrolled for law school, you became a law student.
Well, just after finished secondary education. I then went to Budapest University, where I had a year before going to Cambridge.
It's intrigued me, how could a teenaged law student from Budapest find his way across Europe and enroll to study economics at Cambridge in the, 1934. How did that come about?
My father, my late father, was a bookmaker, a bookie, and one of his clients suggested, who was a great Anglophile, suggested to my father that he should try and provide an English education for his very hard-working and apparently quite talented son. So that's how I came to get it.
So you turned up at Cambridge and you went knocking on door to door, college to college. What was the reaction? How did they receive you?
All very friendly. They were surprised. But I, in fact, presented myself at six colleges. Five accepted me immediately, and the sixth the next day.
And what standard was your English?
It was awful. I had a very difficult time in Cambridge because I was very short of money and I hardly spoke any English.
And what led you to choose economics as a discipline?
Because I thought that eventually I would return to Hungary and practice private international law, for which I thought law and economics would be helpful.
How did you move over the years from being, as you say, mildly on the left, being a great champion of market ideas and limited government and so on?
Simply, reflection and observation. The prevailing tone among undergraduates in Cambridge at the time was very much on the left, and a great respect for the Soviet Union. And I maintained at the time already that a country in which there's ultimately only one employer, cannot be a free society.
You raised the issue of the Soviet Union. How did you feel about its demise a decade ago now?
I was convinced that ultimately that, that it wouldn't last, but I never believed it would disintegrate so rapidly. I thought it would eventually go because the system was so inefficient. Prices so divorced from real cost of production that the system have to go. But I never thought it would go so soon without a shot being fired.
Planning, in that case, central government planning, clearly didn't work. What does this tell us, do you think, about your own field of third world development, where many planning, different forms of planning have been tried?
Much the same. I mean, they haven't, central planning is something which I think is inherently very inefficient. And that is, whether in the third world or in the West.
It's doomed to failure.
Well, it depends how you define failure. If you mean failure of improving living standards or promoting economic progress, yes. If it's a question of keeping the government in power, that's a different story. And in the third world, even more than in the West, the primary aim of any government is to stay in power.
Let's talk a little more about Cambridge in the 1930s. Were you actually taught by Joan Robinson and,
yes,
and Maynard Keynes?
I attended a few of Keynes' lectures. He didn't give many lectures, he gave a few odd lectures. I was a member of a society called the Keynes Club, which met at Keynes' room twice a term, consisting of some dons and some promising undergraduates. And I was a member of that. And Joan Robinson supervised me for a year.
So six times a year, twice a term, six times a year, the brightest students and the faculty would meet at Keynes's house as part of the Keynes Club.
Yes.
To discuss ideas, to discuss...
Somebody presented a paper, and that was then discussed. It was all rigged by Kahn. You see, Kahn would send out slips, give slips of paper to students, members of the club, whom he wanted to talk, and we had to talk. And I was not very articulate in those days.
So Kahn would rig it for people that,
yes,
he wanted to promote?
Yes. I mean, not that was not malicious. I mean, he thought they would have something to contribute or were due to speak, and so rigged the paper that they came up to speak.
And what was it like having Joan Robinson as your tutor?
Now, that was something quite different. She was a very good supervisor. She was my supervisor. But she gradually came very much to dislike me because I was then beginning to be market-oriented and she was totally hostile to the market.
Did you set out to change the world?
I was very naive in those days. I didn't want to change certain things. Which, oddly enough, I did manage to change. For instance, I thought that the smallholders, rubber-growing smallholders, were very unfairly treated under rubber regulation. And I criticized this very effectively, what I thought effectively. And that has changed policy in Malaya, definitely.
You are often called a market-oriented economist. Yet people say that markets produce great inequalities. How do you deal with such an accusation?
Well, first of all, I would say we shouldn't talk about inequalities, but about differences. Because difference is a neutral term, and inequality is a loaded term. And inequality is often equated with inequity. And then the next step leads to the idea that the poor are poor because the rich are rich, i.e. that the rich have extracted their incomes or wealth from the poor, which is quite untrue.
What does lead to these great differences then?
The most important thing, I suppose, the difference in economic abilities. See, people accept the idea that people differ greatly in their athletic abilities, musical abilities, mathematical abilities, but they don't seem to realize that there are also great differences in economic qualities, particularly in the perception and utilization of economic opportunities.
Do you think that the class system, particularly here in your adopted country of Britain, is a major barrier that stops people rising out of poverty?
I don't believe that at all. England is a system, society is one in which people are acutely aware of so small differences. If a civil servant expects to get a CBE, he's mortified. Or if he expects to get a CBE and he gets an OBE, he's again mortified. And perception of differences runs across societies. I mean, if you look into pubs, you have a lounge bar, a saloon bar, and a public bar frequented by slightly different people. But the differences is not the same thing as barriers. John Major, when he became leader of the Conservative Party, he said he will work towards the elimination of a class system. I don't know what he meant by that, that everybody should drink gin and tonic, which is the upper class drink, or should drink dry sherry, which is also upper class, instead of drinking sweet sherry or port, which tend to be lower class drinks. John Major himself is a son of a variety artist. His predecessor was a daughter of a grocer. Her predecessor was a son of a small builder. Not far back, we had Ramsay MacDonald, who was illegitimate son of a fisherwoman. England is an open society. Differences are not barriers.
Let me turn to another area that where critics are ranged against you. Many people claim that poverty in the less developed parts of the world is the result of huge population pressures. How do you react to that?
Simply say it's untrue. It is invalid, because you find that some of the poorest and most backward countries are very thinly populated. In much of Africa, land, including, for example, what you for the former Congo, now Zaire, perhaps it's a different name now, but now is so thinly populated, so over large areas, land is a free good. And contrary, some of the most densely populated countries are very prosperous. Take Hong Kong and Singapore.
So these people that get behind these demands for population control, you think are completely misguided?
They are misguided, although they are often guided by self-interest.
Why is that? How is that?
They benefit from suggestions that they should control people's lives.
Peter, how did you come to get interested in the economics of developing countries?
Because that was years ago, long before then, I did a study of the rubber industry. And then one of West Africa. And that then gradually led me into a wider field of so-called development economics. But these specific studies is the one which started my interest. Subject.
And who or what most influenced you in those early days into doing those particular studies, which in turn led to the broader interest?
I should say I was influenced for a while by a man called John Jukes, Stanley Denison, and soon by Basil Yamy. He influenced me more than anybody else. Denison was a senior undergraduate at Cambridge when I was a freshman. And he took some interest in me and started coaching me. And Jukes wrote on a number of subjects which interested me, but neither of them were professors of mine.
And then later when you came to the LSE, you met Basil Yamy.
Yes.
And he was a great co-author of yours.
Yes, yes.
Let's talk for a moment about Basil. He was, of course, your co-author of a number of your reports. You were close colleagues at the London School of Economics.
Yes.
You co-wrote at least a couple of books together, I believe.
Well, the reason I would be, in a way, not personally, but no, professionally, got on so well, he has a much sharper mind than I have. And I got a more restless mind, they say. There is something to be looked in here, we ought to look into it. He's had a much sharper mind than I have. And that's what compliments each other. We compliment each other.
When did you meet?
In 19, I think it must be 47. At the LSE.
And was he already a market-oriented economist? Was he?
In a very large measure, yes.
And that sort of, you played off each other? There were synergies,
yes,
there?
Yes. Yes. What happened is, I had this, to do this study on West African trade, which was originally commissioned by the then colonial office. And I couldn't quite assemble a great deal of material. On the whole, I think rather successfully, I hope. But I was not very good at putting it together. And I thought of asking Coase, R.H. Coase, to help me with it. Coase, however, couldn't, because he was on the point of going to America. And he suggested I should try Basil Yamy, and that worked.
So it was Coase who introduced you to Yamy?
Very largely, yes.
I was reading the other day in the Oxford Dictionary of Political Quotations, and you are credited in the Oxford Dictionary as with the following quote, aid is a process by which the poor in rich countries subsidize the rich in poor countries. Could you amplify on that a little?
When people talk about aid, they only mean government-to-government subsidies. The aid doesn't go to the miserable creatures we see on our television screen. It goes to their rulers. And these rulers tend to be the most relatively prosperous people in their countries. That's what I meant.
So it's money going from the poor taxpayer in rich countries through our government?
Yes. To the other governments, whose personnel tends to be well off relatively to the rest of the population.
So it sounds as if you feel that aid can't do all that much to help these countries develop.
No, certainly not. Look, the most, if I must talk semi-technical language, the most which aid can do at best is slightly reduce the cost of borrowing in these countries. But these countries can borrow very readily abroad, both their governments and ordinary private people.
So the very best scenario is a slight help. And from that, I would take it that it's often a major hindrance.
Yes. It contributes, promotes the politicization of life in these countries. And that, in turn, intensifies the political struggle and diverts people's attention from economic activity to productive economic activity to political life.
Because that's where there are huge amounts of money to be made.
And strengthen your people's rules over their fellow men.
So what you're saying is that really that aid incentivizes bad policy. The more,
on the whole, yes.
The more I make a mess of things as a third world president or prime minister, the more the West pours money into my coffers.
Yes, indeed. That was evident in the case of Ethiopia, when the misery in Ethiopia, which was freely shown on our television screen, was promoted not by drought, but by government policies. The suppression of trade, which brought it about, that slight unfavorable weather conditions instead of leading to belt tightening led to catastrophes.
So if you were president of Ethiopia, what would you be doing?
I suspect that most other, like us other people, my first concern would be to keep myself in office. That would be my first concern, if I wanted to promote the welfare of the population at large, which is quite unrealistic. I would promote peaceful commerce with Western, with market-oriented countries.
And that in turn led to the development of a whole sub-discipline of economics,
yes,
called development economics.
Yes.
How much were those early days influenced by the Marshall Plan?
Well, the advocates of foreign aid used the the Marshall Plan as an example. Look what the Marshall Plan had done. Well, there was no comparison at all with foreign aid and Marshall Plan. The economies of Western Europe had to be restored, not developed. The economies of so-called Third World, to use a fashionable cliché, had to be developed. Marshall aid, the Western Germany and Western Europe, had to be restored, not developed. The people had, of these countries, particularly Germany, had the institutions, the attitude appropriate to material progress, as obvious from their achievement.
I know I have to be very careful with the words I use around you, but let me ask you why did you just say that the Third World is a cliché?
Because I think if you think about it, it's completely inappropriate to lump together three quarters of mankind under one category. Until, again, for the development of foreign aid, nobody thought of lumping together Asia, Africa, and Latin America into one category.
What would you prefer to say?
I would prefer to say Asia, Africa, and Latin America.
Let's broaden this out. I mean, why, in your view, do some countries develop whilst others stay stagnant?
That's, economic performance and progress depends on people's attitudes and the government and the policies of government. It does not depend on natural resources, but it depends on the conduct of people, and not on their numbers, but on their conduct.
Could you amplify that a little? Their conduct, their commercial conduct?
Well, some people are more interested in improving their material lot than others are. That's so in the so-called Third World as in the West.
How do you react to the accusation that large, rich Western countries have exploited poorer countries, and it's that exploitation that has led them to be in the sorry state that many of them are today?
There's absolutely no truth in it, whatever. Look, again, just look around. Which are the most prosperous countries in Asia and Africa? Those with most Western contacts. Singapore and Hong Kong being the limiting cases. The poorest and most backward are those with no external contacts. The limiting cases being the Amazonian Indians and tribesfolk in Central Africa.
Well, if colonialization and exploitation by the West is not the reason why parts of Africa and Asia and other parts of the world are so poor, what is the explanation?
As you say, lack of people's ambitions and the conduct of the governments.
How can a third world, less developed country, you know, hope to compete these days with the advanced Western economies?
They benefit from the presence of Western economies. They don't have to compete with them. They can take advantage of the presence of advanced Western economies, which provide sources of raw material or industrial goods and advanced technology. It's like the open frontier was to America in the early days of American colonization.
100 years ago, countries such as Argentina, for example, ranked amongst the wealthiest in the world. Now they struggle to get into the top 20 or 30. What's happened there?
Government policies. That's quite straightforward. Above all, Perón, but others as well. That's easily explained. And as I say, material achievement and progress depends on people's attitudes and the conduct of governments.
Take today, a very poor, some of the very poorest Central African countries. Many would say that they cannot possibly hope to take off without a substantial investments of aid. You clearly disagree with that.
Look, in the past, a number of African countries, long before aid was invented, developed by the efforts of the people and the conduct of the governments. Take, for example, Ghana or the Gold Coast as it then was. There are millions of acres on the cocoa in West Africa, in Ghana and in Nigeria, incidentally, every acre owned, planted, and operated by Africans. This incidentally also shows that the notion that the people in these countries are incapable of taking a long view in economic affairs is manifestly untrue. A cocoa tree takes 6 years before it yields an income. And yet these people, hundreds and thousands of them, planted cocoa trees, Africans. And the same applies, incidentally, if we're going the other side of the world, to Southeast Asia. The Malays are supposed to be people living for the day, just watching the coconuts fall off the trees. In fact, they have also millions of acres of the smallholders' cultivation in Malaysia and Indonesia.
Let's talk about some other successes. Hong Kong, you visited Hong Kong.
Yes.
How do you credit its success?
The Chinese interests and resourcefulness. British administration, maintenance of law and order, and Chinese industry and resourcefulness.
What other countries do you admire that have managed to...
I don't admire, just notice. I try not to judge, but just to describe and analyze.
Well, which would be your best example of a country that has followed the kinds of advice that you'd give, and what would be the worst example?
Well, the best example is Hong Kong.
And the worst?
Any number of African countries. Ethiopia, for example.
Don't countries with very low or even no natural resources face a great disadvantage?
No. Singapore and Hong Kong have no natural resources to speak of. Hong Kong was an empty rock until the middle of the 19th century. Singapore was a swamp. No natural resources. The only resource which matters really human beings. That is the ultimate resource, as Julian Simon said. To use a phrase coined by Julian Simon.
So it's the people and their attributes and the rules within which they operate?
Yes, but that also tends to depend on themselves, because the rules under which they operate depend on the government, which is brought about or put in place by the people. Property rights are extremely important in securing personal freedom and the rule of law. I've recently been reading a very interesting book on this subject by Richard Pipes, who is research professor at Harvard. And the book is called Property and Freedom. It's not the easiest reading in the world, but it's intelligible. All you need to concentrate. And that elaborates the importance between property and personal freedom. And preoccupation with inequality tends to undermine property rights.
So what you're saying is that differences in income spur envy, and envy leads to an attack on property rights.
Yes, but particularly if you call differences, that is less likely to happen than if you call them inequality.
When you first began to publish these ideas and to talk about these ideas, how were you received?
I give you an unambiguous answer: badly.
By everybody, by your fellow academics, by the public?
No, by my fellow academics. because there were also many of them were on the gravy train of aid. But from the public at large, I had quite a substantial fan mail who heard about what I was, came across my views when published, and would write to me. And the theme was generally of this fan mail, thank you for helping me to keep my sanity.
So this was members of the public who had come to similar conclusions themselves.
And yes, and who quite often came to similar conclusions, but often didn't know how to formulate them. And I formulated them for them.
Let's talk about the gravy train. This is what the grants they were getting from international agencies, or the grants they were getting to go and do studies.
No, many of them were on various forms of government contracts, were and are. And you see, development economics and foreign aid are intimately linked. There was no development aid until President Truman's point four in 1949. That led to foreign aid, and that led to development economics. There was no such subject of development economics until after the Second World War.
Was anybody else, other than you and your co-author Basil Yamy, was anybody else doing similar work?
No, the nearest thing were certain anthropologists, like Raymond Firth, for example, who's professor of anthropology at London.
What was he doing?
He made studies of, for example, Malayan fishing villages.
And he was coming to similar conclusions as
you? No, he didn't branch into this, but he gave good description and analysis of life among the fisher folk of Malaya.
And you as an economist could look at that work and see that the fishermen were acting in a long-term rational way, that they were making long-term investments?
Yes.
Just like your cocoa growers and your
rubber growers?
Yes. Your first scholarly articles were about the pig and milk industries in England and how the government had moved in on them and created so-called marketing boards which effectively had rigged the market.
Right, but that was, of course, to a considerable extent, under the pressure from the farmers themselves. Whereas in West Africa, they have instruments for depressing farm incomes.
And in England, they were introduced in peacetime, whereas I think in West Africa, they were more of a wartime creation.
Yes, but it was immediately clear they would be carried on indefinitely.
So the pig and the pig breeders and the milk dairy farmers,
yes,
got together with the government to rig the market,
yes,
to increase prices.
Yeah, incomes, really.
To stabilise their incomes at higher levels.
Yes.
And this was your first work as a young economist, your first published work.
Yes.
Let's talk about three or four of your best-known books, how they came to be written, the impact they had. In chronological order, The Rubber Industry, your first major piece of work, that really came about how? What were the origins of that piece of work?
I worked for an firm of East India merchants and rubber growers. That largely influenced me to write that book. And a major theme of that book is the importance of the rubber growing smallholders, which up to that point was not recognized.
And when you returned, you wrote a report for the Colonial Office?
Yes.
And then that report was turned into the full-blown...
They're separate. They were separate. That report, which I have here in this flat, I rather regret. It was overstating things, over-emphatic, a bit shrill, and I regret it.
When the full book came out, began... process of establishing your reputation. It was the first major building block, would I say, in the corpus, the Bauer?
I should say possibly some of my earlier articles, just about the same time I had an article on the working of rubber regulation in the Economic Journal. And that created a certain amount of attention, attracted a certain amount of attention. Mm.
What was the argument of that article?
How the rubber regulation worked and how unfairly it treated the smallholders. And that created a certain amount of attention, the importance of the smallholders at all.
The next major piece of work was the book on West African trade.
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about how that came about.
Well, I think the way it came about is that there was a lot of agitation, mostly behind the scenes, about the operations in West Africa of the United Africa Company, which is a subsidiary of Unilever. And it was proposed that there should be an inquiry by the Monopolies Commission into the activities of the United Africa Company. It was felt, I think, some people in the colonial office felt there was not really a suitable subject for the Monopolies Commission. It's better to actually investigate the situation and write about it. That's how that book came about.
The big contribution I recollect was that you demonstrated that these small farmers in whatever industry, whatever particular part of agriculture they might be, were able to take the long-term view, that they could invest in crops that took a great many years to mature.
Yes. Applied both to Malaya and to West Africa, yes.
What was the reception at the time? Because they both came out from very reputable publishers. Were they well received, well reviewed?
No, not at all.
And what do you credit that to?
That leads us into the murky fields of the sociology of knowledge. You can explain by people's views, examine them in terms of logic and empirical evidence, but why people hold certain views is much more difficult and problematical.
When I look at your work, Peter, the third book that stands out to me is your 1961 Indian Economic Policy book. Just tell us a little bit about the background to that.
I visited India a bit, I read a good deal about it, and I just want to expose some of the shortcomings of the Indian policy.
It was being very much held up as an example, wasn't it? It kept introducing five-year plans.
Yes, of course, you see, the very idea of five-year plans reflects the Soviet influence. The five-year plans started with the Soviet five-year plans.
Looking at the rest of your work, it seems to me it splits into two halves after the rubber industry book, the West African trade book, and the Indian economic policy book. You wrote several texts with Basil Yamy, or your what I often think of as my favourite Bauer book, Descent on Development.
Yes.
And then you had many books of collections of your articles and speeches that came out.
Not all that many. Descent on Development is that, and there is one called Reality and Rhetoric, which came after Descent on Development. It's also a collection of papers. And right now, a book of mine has been published in the last few days by Princeton. And that's a collection of papers.
Are there, in all these decades of your writing and studying, are there any third world, so-called third world countries that you would point to as being good examples? Or are there any particular political leaders that you admire?
No, among people I admire most is B.R. Shanoy, an Indian economist, who figures prominently in some of my writings. I would say that as a polity, I admire Hong Kong. There's a country with no natural resources, whatever, and has become a major industrial power.
We talked before about your work on marketing boards, some of your early work before your first job was in your first job as an agricultural economist, concerned the marketing boards in the United Kingdom.
Yes.
And then in your later work in Ghana, of course, you came across marketing boards there.
You see, in the West, the farmers are a powerful lobby, political lobby, and that enables them, obviously, to present common agricultural policy is the latest phase to have their incomes maintained at the expense of the taxpayer or at the expense of the consumer with government intervention. In the so-called third world, the situation is exactly the other way around. The urban groups are far more powerful than the farmers. And that's how it's come about that the West African marketing boards, which are buying monopolies, have managed to keep farm incomes way below market prices, world market prices.
So in the advanced economies, marketing boards enhance incomes of farmers. In third world countries, they depress their income. Would you say that some of your work in the area of development economics, where you put so much emphasis on human capital and human attributes, really is a precursor of many more recent developments in the theory of human capital?
I never use the expression human capital. I think, although it's very widely accepted, I don't think it's a fortunate exception. For example, in Southeast Asia, particularly in Malaysia, immigrant Chinese, who were not only penniless, who were very, very poor, but also illiterate. They can hardly say to have contained much capital in the accepted sense of the term. They had the right motivation for material progress. I don't like the term human capital. You see, capital is a man-made instrument of production. That is not the case of human beings.
How much of an audience have you enjoyed in countries such as India? How much of your views been translated and broadcast outside of the British and American markets?
I had certain following in India. But that was because there was an outstanding Indian economist who largely independently of me, came to the same conclusion as I did.
This was B.R. Shenoy?
Yes.
Tell us a little about Shenoy.
Shenoy was a magnificent man. He was a hero and a saint. I once gave a lecture in his memory in India, and I said I consider it as an honor that I should lecture in memory of such a man.
He was highly critical of central government, the five-year plans that the...
Yes.
The Indians, he foresaw that they would all fail and collapse. Are the disciples of Peter Bauer now out in academia and in the policy world, in politics?
No.
Surely somebody must have picked up your baton and be writing and publishing on the lines that you were doing?
Well, to some extent you can say that about Yemi, who's a bit younger than myself, and whom I influenced very much. He also influenced me, I may add. There was a Turkey called Gönensey, who to some extent followed my ideas.
George Ayiti, maybe?
Well?
George Ayiti?
Yes, I think you got him, you are right.
And I seem to recall you speaking very favorably of a Canadian usher?
Yes, quite, yes indeed. I was a first-class statistician who exposed the misleading use of statistics in the context of national income statistics. A first class man.
These are the statistics that show people enjoying impossibly low incomes.
Yes.
These tables that one sees in development economics books showing that people in a particular country earn enough for
annual income of $40 or so, and thereabouts, and Usher exposed that.
Let's concentrate on that for a moment. How did he expose it? I mean, he showed that they didn't take into account
subsistence economy, subsistence production, and various forms of transport costs, That is quite technical.
And essentially he showed that those people couldn't, simply were not that poor.
Exactly.
They might still be poor, but they certainly weren't as poor as the
indeed.
As the data.
And Usher was particularly well qualified because he lived for years in Thailand and had a Thai wife.
But there are now today, one does come across the Bauer type arguments much more than 30 years ago, say.
Yes.
Cropping up in journals from think tanks and the like.
I can claim very little credit for that. The evident bankruptcy of foreign aid and development aid in a number of countries, which had brought, brought people to some extent to their senses.
Have you won the debate?
No. Well, intellectually, yes, but not practically. Intellectually, I won it. It was not difficult, actually.
I can recall you speaking, I think it was in the early 1970s, at the Oxford Union in a debate on population. And my recollection is that in that speech you said that a birth of a child depresses average national income, whereas the birth of a pig increases average national income, given
that's,
the way we...
That shows the absurdities and the anomalies of partly conventional wisdom in this field. It is true, actually. Not that it matters. Instance a calf rather than a pig. The birth of a calf adds to the national income. The birth of a child immediately depresses it.
And you use this illustration my recollection is correct, to illustrate the absurdity of national income statistics.
Yes.
And the absurdity of...
The conventional ones.
The conventional ones. And to undermine those who wish to control population.
Yes. Quite unsuccessfully, I may add.
Given the charitable impulse we all have, how should how would you advise somebody to direct their personal philanthropy? If somebody came to you who had assets and said they were concerned about a particular third world country that was struggling to emerge, what would you advise them to do?
Find out, to locate persons with real experience in these countries, medical missionaries or missionaries, and see how they operate and help them.
You wouldn't advise them to try to do anything in terms of the underlying institutions of that society or the...
Because there is a great deal of condescension in discussions here in the West toward the so-called third world. It always somehow implied that we have emerged and developed without external assistance or help, but these blighted people can't. And I don't hold with that.
I know one has to be very careful with one's words around you, Peter. I know one word that you don't like at all is that of robber baron.
Yes.
What do you say to people who say that the American early American capitalists in, say, the late 19th, early 20th century, that they were robber barons? What do you say to them?
I would say they are mistaken. They may be well-meaning, but they are mistaken. Because the so-called robber barons were mostly creative entrepreneurs.
Are we back to envy? Is this envy-driven?
That's in a large measure that. Yeah, misunderstandings, genuinely, but very largely envy-driven. It is, particularly in England, or the Anglo-Saxon countries, envy is a very powerful factor in politics.
In your view, these were great men who brought a great deal of wealth, created a great deal of wealth, created jobs, advanced.
Yes, you can think of exceptions of people who were dishonest and so on, but very largely this is the situation. Take for example, Henry Ford.
Right.
He pioneered the mass-produced automobile, and that really transformed existence.
Let's turn away from those early books and talk in more general terms about how you came to be broadly defined as a market-oriented economist. Who most influenced the development of your thinking?
Well, to some extent, Hayek. But to a large extent, I developed it myself. For instance, when I was an undergraduate in the mid-30s in Cambridge, the economics students, or the whole economics faculty, were all admirers of the Soviet system. And I was critical from the world go, because I see a society in which there's only one employer cannot be a free society. But I developed this myself.
When would you have met Hayek? When did you first come across him?
For a short time at the LSE. When I first came, I was at the LSE in two different spells. At my first spell, he was there, just briefly, and I met him there. But I was also, of course, influenced, like thousands of other people, influenced by his book, The Road to Serfdom.
What of his earlier works would you have read?
Some of his essays, the use of knowledge in society, I think is extremely important work.
And how important a figure would you judge Hayek to have been in the broad context of the 20th century?
I would say he's one of the intellectual giants.
And his founding of the Mont Pelerin Society, how important was that to network the remnant of classical liberal scholars?
In the early days, the late 40s, or mid to late 40s, I think it was very important to help Hegel feel that they're not entirely alone. There are others who think like they do. But by now, these ideas have been so widely accepted that I don't think its significance is what it used to be.
Your name in German means, the name Bauer means?
Peasant.
Peasant. And when you were elevated to the House of Lords, by Queen Elizabeth II, I believe you joked about British society and being, in your view, classless. And you said, in your case, you'd gone from peasant to peer.
Yes.
In one generation.
In one lifetime.
In one lifetime. Slightly more than a generation, true. So from peasant to peer in one lifetime.
Yes.
What can we learn from that example? What does that example tell us?
Yet another countless example, that England is an open society.
How significant has it been for you being a member of the House of Lords?
Well, needless to say, I'm extremely glad to be there. My influence has been absolutely negligible. And by and large, I was disappointed by the level of discourse in the House of Lords. All of us there have security of tenure. In fact, the opinions you hear are the conventional opinions of the so-called quality dailies.
Tell me about Milton Friedman. His life and yours have overlapped at times.
He took a sabbatical in England, and he chose to do the membership of my college. And I learned a great deal from Milton Friedman.
This was 1953-54, I believe.
Yes, yes.
So you were professional colleagues together there for a year?
Yes, yes.
What was that like? You were both young men?
He's a bit older than I am, but he is infinitely my intellectual superior.
I'm just trying to imagine what it must have been like at Caius in 1953-54. You would have been 37, 38, 39 years old. Milton and Rose Friedman would have been maybe 4 or 5 years older than you.
Yeah.
Sparks, there must have been intellectual sparks flying around the pair of you with your views and Caius in the 50s. Surely in the common room there must have been ferocious debates.
No. Debates, discussions in Caius were on the whole, as in many other colleges, common room, very disappointing. I mean, things were discussing, sure. Should staircases with numbers by letter or by number arranged, that sort of thing. You know, there was actually one outstanding figure at the time at Keyes. There were actually several good ones, but one outstanding figure, R.A. Fisher, who was a giant, one of the makers of modern statistics, and also the, almost certainly the greatest British biologist, Darwin. And he and Friedman were on the whole on the same wavelength, and they talked together.
What were the two sharpest minds you ever came across?
I should say, it's not just an easy question, not just an easy answer, but I would say Milton Friedman and Basil Yamy.
And what makes you say that?
Because I know them and I've read their writings. And as they were, I know both of them personally.
You're always very precise in your use of terms, and you've, for all that I've been a student of yours for 30 years, you still correct me. And I believe that this is on your coat of arms. The motto is, what is the motto?
Let us be free from Kant.
Let us be free from Kant.
Kant, yes.
What do you hope that the scholars of the future will say when they look back at your life and your work and the body of work that you achieved? What do you think they'll say about this lone voice raised against the establishment?
Well, perhaps some will say, some may say, I was a man of moral courage, which is seriously lacking on the contemporary scene. I mean, I certainly will not have a standing in the eyes of the world, such as, rightly, such as Buchanan has, for instance, or Hayek. But I think I shall be commended by some people for, call it, clarity and courage.